We have come in our studies of Romans chapter 8 to verse 18. There's a difference, of course, in the paragraph divisions depending on which translation you're using, but I'm going with the New American Standard, and I think that verse 18 does start somewhat of a new train of thought, even though it's built right off of the foundation of verses 16 and 17. But in Romans chapter 8, Paul is clearly attempting to get his readers to buy into this thing called life by the Spirit. In order to accomplish that, he presents the truth that what one anticipates as outcomes is extremely critical. We live an enormous amount of our life anticipating the outcomes of the things that we're engaged in, and if we change our thinking about what the outcome might be, it will probably affect whether we're going to do this or not. The point, though, is that what you anticipate as an outcome has an enormous impact on whether or not you're going to invest in whatever it is. So in our last study, in verse 17, where we talked about Paul's view of destiny for us, he said that if we were children, we were heirs of God. And then he said, if we suffered together with Christ, we become fellow heirs together with him in his being glorified together with him. We went through all of that. And we saw that he's basically making a distinction between the kind of inheritance that a person has as a child of God, as the executor of power and the promise of eternal life, a promise that is available to everybody regardless of where they are in their own development as a person in God's family. The newborn babe in Christ, like the thief on the cross, who only has 3 hours to live before he actually inherits his inheritance, he has what I call the basic salvation package, which has to do with the promise of eternal life in terms of the body, soul, and spirit, as presented in the scriptures, a glorified body, a completely sin-free, unified soul with Christ, and a spirit that is completely committed to the kingdom issue of being a servant to all who are in the kingdom, because the spirit and its function is a part of the promise of life. You have to have something significant to do in order to be able to live well. Well, there is a sense in which if you become a believer and die shortly thereafter, or you become a believer and you don't die for 80 years after, but you don't grow up during that period of time, there's a sense in which the time you lived here on the earth didn't make any difference in terms of the inheritance simply because you got the basic salvation package. Give it to you. Divine fiat, given by promise, you believe it, it's yours. But Paul isn't satisfied with that concept of salvation because to him it's a total waste of all of your life here on earth not to make progress and develop as a son of God. So in this chapter he talks about the sons being different from the children in that the sons have learned to follow the leading of the Holy Spirit, and the sons being led by the Spirit into fellow participation with Christ in his sufferings are then inheriting an enhanced a package of glory, participation in the glory of God, that person who doesn't develop doesn't have. So that's kind of what's going on here. He's presenting the inheritance as a destiny issue, both for children and sons. But this evening, as we start in verse 18, we're going to be looking into the significance of being heirs as it's given in terms of the essential character of the Father, because he said we are to be glorified together with Christ if we suffer together with him. And the idea there is that being glorified together with him is very much like his prayer in John 17, where he asked the Father to glorify him with the glory that he had before he came down here. And the whole idea of the glory as the inheritance is being able to participate in the impact and significance of all of the various attributes that affect the way we're going to function in the Christ kingdom and the abilities that we have had developed in and through us by the Spirit while we were here. It's the direct outworking of the judgment seat of Christ, where the gold, silver, and precious stones are, the outworking of the Spirit's involvement with us over time, and then our position in the kingdom is assigned to us on the basis of where we fit because we developed in those areas. So the bottom line is, it's the issue of the character of the Father. And there are two big sides to that issue. Because the suffering side indicates that there is something about the Father in his determination to bring many sons to glory that stands firm, even though that determination results in the permission of much great evil in the world and the disastrous consequences that affect those that are impacted by the evil that's done. God's tolerance of evil is a part of his determination to bring many sons to glory. And that's the side of the issue that we don't like, because we don't like the idea of having to suffer. But the whole idea of suffering is that it's an expression, the fact that we have to suffer is an expression of something that's true about God, the Father. So, kind of in other words, the character of the Father includes a willingness to tolerate a relatively large degree of wickedness in his creation for a relatively long period of time. And I use relatively. I mean, long period of time, 6,000 or 7,000 years is, to God, 6 or 7 days. To us, it's almost infinity, because we live 70 years, which isn't even a part of a day. So for us, 7,000 years is forever. And God puts up with that. And Paul even refers to that in Romans, where he talks about God being willing to put up with the wicked for a while, because he's willing to do some things for the sake of his people. So there's that side of the issue, is the suffering together. And then there's the side that is also an outgrowth of the Father's glory. And that's his determination that no one who trusts in him will have any regrets when the fulfilled promises completely dominate their experience. We may have some difficulty, regret kind of things while we're going through the process. But once we're on the other side and the promises fulfilled are completely dominating our experience, we're not going to have any regrets. That's why destiny is such a big deal. Contrary to what everybody is saying these days, it's not the journey that's important, it's the destination. Everybody says, it's not the destination, but the journey. Well, that's baloney. It's the destination. And that puts the journey in its context. And that's what the issue here in verses 17 and 18 is. Because clearly there is a suffering aspect, and clearly there is a glorification aspect. And they're very different in terms of our experience. But they are connected. So, verse 18 brings about the connection. It starts out with the word for. And that's always an introduction to some reasoning based on some things that he said. And he says that we're going to be co-heirs together with the Christ, which has to do with the Messianic kingdom. It has to do with being a part of the king's rule, because those that are heirs of his kingdom end up serving in a ruling kind of capacity, where the ruling is all about serving. It's not just a concept of the servant king, but it's actual, where everything you do is for somebody else's benefit and for somebody else's sake. And the king is the greatest at that, the best at that, and then everybody else in the kingdom, depending on how they developed in this world, in their walk, will fit in everywhere. All of creation is always going to be creation, which means it's always going to be a dependent, needy reality. God's the only unneedy person that exists, and anything that he creates is fully dependent on his constant supply in order to continue to exist. So when he says, for I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that's to be revealed to us, he is actually arguing for a legitimate basis for suffering. So the first big issue is the actual perspective that we take, because the word translated consider is a key word. The word consider is also the word reckon. It's the word impute. It's used in the New Testament whenever a final conclusion is being drawn that will have a significant downrange consequence because the decision that's being drawn has to do with your perspective of the destiny, the outcome, and it has everything to do with whether you're going to invest in that outcome. So when we think about this, considering that word is used in 40 texts in the New Testament, with Paul using it 19 times in Romans alone, and 11 of those 19 are found in chapter 4. So it's a huge word in terms of Paul's doctrine of the gospel of God. It's particularly potent in chapter 4, where the issue is justification by grace through faith. But it's important in Romans, because the only other book where there is a significant number at all of the uses of the term is 2 Corinthians, and it's only got 7 verses in the whole letter that use the word. So you compare 19 in Romans to 7 in 2 Corinthians, and then every other use of the 40 is one here and two there, and one here and one here and one here and two there, and so on. So the point that I'm trying to make is, when he says, I consider, he's using a word that's really an essential part of his theology in Romans. And perhaps the most revealing is chapter 3, verse 28. Because when Paul starts out in Romans 1, talking about the gospel that he's not ashamed of in verse 16, he immediately in verse 18 starts in with his presentation. And in verse 18, he says that the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and so on. And he goes all the way through Romans 1 talking about how men have turned away from God, and because of that, God has turned away from them and had given them over to the lust of their own flesh so that they're distorted and perverted. Their own bodies are twisted out of their natural use, and you end up with all this real wicked perversion that is now mainstreamed in our culture. And he ends up the chapter 1 by talking about these people who know that their behavior is worthy of judgment, but they not only do what they know is worthy of judgment, but they take delight in people who do like they do. So the first chapter of Romans is all about the wickedness of mankind in general. And then you start into chapter 2 and he starts going into this mindset that, yeah, Romans 1 says they know it's judgment worthy, but in chapter 2 there's these people who reckon, who think, who act on the basis of this kind of logic, that if they acknowledge that it's wrong, that that's enough. If they acknowledge it's wrong, they'll escape the judgment of God even if they do it, just because they acknowledge it. He says, do you think this? Is this the way you're reasoning? Is this your reckoning? That you who say these things are wrong and do the same, that you'll escape the judgment of God? And then he goes down through chapter 2, and then he goes into the Jew, particularly in chapter 2, talking about how they think that they're so superior because they've got the oracles of God and all of this stuff, but they actually cause the Gentiles to deride the name of the God of the Jews simply because their wickedness is so great. So they make the Gentiles blaspheme the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob by their behavior. And then he goes on into chapter 3. And then at the end of, or close to the end of chapter 3, he says in verse 28, for we maintain, our word there is reckon. We reckon, we conclude. This is our final conclusion. And that is this: a man is justified by faith apart from the works of the law. He couldn't have said anything more diametrically opposed to Jewish theology than that sentence. In Jewish theology, in which he was raised and for which he persecuted and attempted to destroy the church, was because justification was by performance. It was obedience to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It was completely works of law based. And Paul is saying, we conclude, based on chapters 1, 2, and 3, that a man is justified by faith apart from works of the law, and the reason is because otherwise there won't be anybody justified at all. So when he uses this term, we conclude or maintain, though I think maintain is a wrong idea there, because he's actually talking about drawing a conclusion. And in chapter 8, verse 18, he says, I reckon, I consider, I've drawn this conclusion. And what he's trying to do is make sure that we understand that what he's going to say in verse 18 is, in a sense, a bottom line conclusion, not of doctrine, but of actual confident reality. I am convinced. Paul wouldn't say, it's part of my doctrinal formulation that suffering is good for developing, you know, your participation in glory. He wouldn't say that. He would say, this is the way life is. This is it. I reckon this. And the reason that he's saying it that way is because the conclusion really can't be overstated. It's the absolute foundation of all the life that's to come. If we're to be glorified together with Christ on the basis of suffering together with him, then there's got to be a rationale that underwrites that and says, okay, you want to participate in life to a greater degree than you can imagine, then you're going to have to buy this principle. And the conclusion, as I've already said, runs counter to everything that the Jews had concluded after 1,500 years of being in the crosshairs of God's focus. Jewish experience of God for 1,500 years had resulted, because of their rebellion against him, in a theology of performance salvation that was absolutely and totally destructive of everything relational. Paul said it will automatically ruin to boasting, and boasting will automatically destroy relationships. So in a relational universe, there is nothing more pernicious than the notion that a person's performance is the foundation of his relationship with God or other people. So when Paul uses this term in Romans over and over and over, he's laying down some very solid things, life truths that are immutably true. Unchanging, absolutely dependable. That's the issue of our actual perspective. When I consider something with this term, it means, hey, this is the foundation of the way I think. And the issue that Paul has in view in verse 18 is the issue of suffering that is endemic to creation at this time. Now, Paul is no ignoramus. He did not go around unaware of just how large a part people's reckoning regarding the presence of evil plays into their willingness or unwillingness to trust in the Father. It is one of the most fundamental reasons why people rebel against the gospel and against God. They say, if God's as good as he's cracked up to be, why is there so much evil in the world? If God really loved us, he wouldn't let these bad things happen. No. It's not like Paul doesn't know that people think that way. In fact, it's one of the major philosophical conundrums for philosophers. If they hadn't spent so much time developing the philosophers, that might not be such a problem for them. But nonetheless, this whole idea that there is evil in the creation of a good God means that God's not good or he's not powerful. Because if he was powerful, he wouldn't allow it. If he was good, he wouldn't allow it. Either he's not good or he's not powerful. Well, the whole assumption there is that nothing good comes from evil. Well, that's just not true. It's a lie. At issue is the actual daily experience of all people of seriously unpleasant and sometimes extremely painful facts, realities, experiences. Nobody goes through life without running smack into unpleasant and sometimes extremely painful things. Nobody. Nobody gets away. It's there. And Paul wouldn't even try to get around that. But it's a potent challenge to faith in the good Father, because it lurks in this reality of how can a good Father permit those who most closely identified with him to suffer, often horrendously. Nobody would argue that the Bible doesn't present Jesus as the Son of God, the most favored object of his love. Nobody would argue that. And yet, it was that most beloved Son that suffered the horrendous reality of Calvary that goes way beyond the physical facts of the 3 days because of who he was. When the Father and the Son and the Spirit agreed together that they would redeem fallen, sinful creatures, they knew that the cost to them was going to be, in a very real sense, an infinite and permanent experience on their part. They would never get away from the reality of the explosion of death into the midst of the living God ever. It's permanently with them. That was part of the recognition of the cost of Calvary. Human beings don't even consider that. They think, well, Jesus suffered for 3 or 4 hours and then he died and then he was raised from the dead and everything's peachy keen ever after. Well, the reason it's peachy keen is because God doesn't have such a negative fixation on the issues of suffering for others' sake. If he did, he would have never done it. So, Paul addresses this challenge of the issue of suffering in light of the fact that the Father's plan included the suffering, especially the suffering of Christ and also the sufferings of those who suffered together with him, followed by the glorification of Christ and the glorification of those who are glorified together with him. He addresses this issue. He actually mitigates the challenge that's involved in that by three things. Number one, he deliberately addresses it head on. He definitively limits it to the sufferings of this present time. It's actually this now time. And time in the biblical perspective is less than a puff of smoke. So in the light of eternity, time is here and gone. And Paul says that suffering is limited to the now time, at least for the people of God. Now, he does not mean by that any contradiction to the biblical scenario of an eternal form of justice poured out where the smoke of the torment ascends up forever, never, 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 never. He's not addressing that. He's addressing the children of God being subjected to suffering and their confidence that their Father is good. So he limits it to the present time and he introduces the issue of not worthiness. The sufferings are not worthy to be compared with the glory. That not worthiness is like, in the light of the glory, the suffering isn't even a blip on the radar. The radar needle is going around, the signals are going out and bouncing back, and if there's something out there, it'll create a blip on the screen, and as it gets closer, it'll get to be a bigger blip, and then they'll be able to identify what it is. Suffering, no matter where you go in human history to the most horrendous treatment of human beings, of other human beings, that you can document in history, some of the most vile and hateful and despicably painful things that men could dream up to treat other their fellow human beings with. He says even those things in their magnitude are not even a blip on the screen. In the light of the glory that's to be revealed. So he's simply saying, look, suffering is a part of the package. It does not deny the goodness of the good God. Satan thinks that he's got a real lock on an argument that God's not as good as he's cracked up to be. But it's a lie. And he keeps promoting this lie because he's not good. He wants everybody to believe him, but his reasons for wanting their faith are purely selfish, totally. And God's reasons for wanting people to believe him are for their sake, not his. Satan has something to gain by people having confidence in him. God has nothing to gain from that. He has only to give. That's a part of the character issue. But that's the first big issue, that suffering is the issue. It's the issue. It's the thing that we all draw back from and our bodies automatically bounce off of anything that's painful. You touch a hot stove, your hand comes off without thought. Just, it's automatic. So the second big issue, the first one is our actual perspective. The second big issue is the biblical perspective. And there are some issues that are involved that are inescapably essential. According to Paul's theology, the sufferings of the now time are essential to a proper grasp of the essence of life. Now, I say that because earlier in Romans, Paul said that God was willing to tolerate the wickedness in order to make his wrath and power known. Which means that if he didn't tolerate the wickedness, neither wrath nor power would be known. In other words, here would be two big truths about God that would be forever kept from the understanding of any of his creation. They would never know his outrage. They would never know his outraged justice. They would never know his antipathy for selfishness. They would never know any of the things that are true about him that can only be known against the backdrop of the permission of evil in the setting. And the interesting thing about that is Jesus said that eternal life is knowing God. So that if you are blocked from the knowledge of God in some way, your experience of eternal life has suddenly been diminished. The capacity for it has been diminished. You can't enter into the fullness of life because the fullness of the life giver is being hidden from you. At least part of it. And Hebrews 5:8 says that even Jesus learned from the things that he suffered. And Hebrews 2:10 says he was made perfect by his sufferings. Now we understand that this is talking about Jesus in his humanity as he was being prepared for his position as the great high priest for the people of God in the presence of the Father. And he learned from the things he suffered because human beings learn. It's a progression of development. It's not instantaneously omniscient awareness. And Jesus, when he limited himself to human brain because he took upon himself a human form, he automatically had to learn. And so he was invested in learning constantly. Well, a part of the reality of having to learn is the suffering. Even if it's for the non-bookworm, the suffering of having to be a bookworm. I mean, there are some people for whom studying is a tedious suffering. But you don't do it, you don't learn. If you don't learn, then your life is diminished by what you don't know. So that's part of the issue. The sufferings are an essential element in the grasp of the essence of the truth about God in all of his attributes. And these sufferings are part of a process that is to end in overwhelming success. The sufferings are going to lead to an overwhelming success. So those are issues that are inescapably essential. The sufferings are essential to life itself, and they're part of a process that ends in an overwhelming success. But there are also some issues involved in this verse where the issues are set in a specific experience frame. There is the now time, and then there is the eternal future. And the now time is a staging time. It's a preparatory time. It's a period in which God is taking sinners and bringing them into the actual experience of their sainthood. He's bringing many sons to glory. It's a process, and it's a hard process in many, many respects. All you have to do is look at how much people have to suffer in order for them to come to grips with certain things. Once in my ministry life, I took a side job being a housing inspector for HUD, for the federal government. And one of my jobs was to go to all of these properties that the rents were being paid by the federal government. And so the owners of those properties had to keep them up to a certain level of adequacy. And in order to get them to do that, they had to have inspectors come around once a year. So, you know, the owner at least once a year had to have his property up to speed or the government wouldn't pay his rent anymore. Well, they wanted that money. That was the outcome they were looking for, so they were willing to do that. Well, I walked into one of those places one day to inspect it, and it was just a habit of mine when I walked into the kitchen to just bounce my hand on the burners. I would turn the switch on, bounce my hand on the burner just to see if it was warming up, and that's how I inspected the stovetop, if it wasn't gas. Well, I went into one of those one day, and I turned the switch on, and because the lady had just turned it off before she answered the door. How many times do you have to do that before you quit using that methodology to find out? Well, it depends on whether you learned from what you've suffered. If you haven't learned, then the question is, are you any smarter than a post? But nonetheless, if you've got to do that 3 or 4 times before you get it, it's essential that you get it, or you'll burn your hand to pieces. So what I'm trying to say here is the sufferings are part of the process. The experience frames are deliberately limited to the now and then the future. And the now is a pretty high, intense form, and we're subject to a great deal of necessity learning, which often involves some levels of pain. Well, the now time is seen to be in the text as eminently limited. It's the now time. It's just this limited frame. And I use eminently meaning in a very high-level view. It's extremely limited. It's supposed to be seen as limited time. But the future, the eternal future with the glory that's to come, that's to be seen as imminently possible. Not imminently, but imminently. I am. In other words, it's immediately possible. It's perhaps even in the next few minutes possible that we're going to go into this future, that Jesus is going to come and the trumpet's going to sound, the voice of the archangel, and suddenly we're going to be what we're going to be forever and ever and ever. So the now time and the future time are in there. And then he makes this profound statement. The sufferings of the now time are not worthy, and the to be compared is, the words in the King James are italicized because there's no words for to be compared. The issue is worthy. But the issue of worthy means you compare something. You compare this to that, and if it's not worthy, then you say it's not worthy. If it is worthy, you say it is. John used the term for comparing himself to Jesus when he said, I'm not worthy to loose the thong of his sandal. He was putting himself below the lowest level of a servant when he said, I don't even qualify to put my fingers on the thong of his sandal and pull. I'm not even that comparable to him. So this idea of worthiness is an issue of comparability. And the issue of worthiness has primarily to do with a kind of mental association where one thing is deemed somewhat equal to another. We have all kinds of illustrations in our world where, for example, in the workaday world, every person that gets up and goes to work has already decided that the wage he's making and the effort he's giving are worthy. They're comparable. They're significantly equal apt. Now, why some person's labor gets $100 an hour and others get $10 an hour, that's never been worked out in anybody's head. But everybody that goes to work only goes to work because of the outcomes he's anticipating, and one of those is the check. And if he wasn't satisfied with what he was getting for his labor, he wouldn't do it anymore. So, it's comparable. But there are some things that are not comparable. And the word not here is ook. It means absolutely not. It's the strongest single word negative in Greek. It's not comparable. It's emphatically so. And the thing that's not comparable is, or the two things that are not comparable are, the suffering, no matter how horrendous it may be, and the glory that is to be revealed to us. Let me give you an illustration. I was looking for a way to kind of emphasize this thing, and I asked the computer what the most expensive automobile in the world was. There's a family in Sweden called Koenigsegg. That's their name, Koenigsegg. And I assume I'm pronouncing it properly, but nonetheless, they must have a lot of wealth because they're into building extremely high-end sports cars. And they happen to have built the most expensive sports car that's ever been built. It's the Koenigsegg CCXR Trevita. They were going to build three of them, but the process was so difficult and tedious that they ended up building only two. So there's only two of them in the world. And that fighter, James Meriwether, or whatever his name is, he bought one. Cost him $4.8 million. It's not worth anything except as a trophy because you didn't dare go out on the highway and drive this thing. Somebody might bump you. There isn't anybody that's going to insure a $4.8 million car that has such a tedious process that they're not going to repair it if you do break it. It'll get 0 to 60 in 2.9 seconds. It's got every kind of conceivable thing, even a USB port. I mean, it's got everything you can imagine. Super high performance, costs $4.8 million. And I would say that if you thought that you should be able to buy that for a dime, that your offer is not comparable. A dime doesn't compare to $4.8 million. It's not even a blip on the radar. And that's the issue of the sufferings. The sufferings are the dime. The $4.8 million is the glory to be revealed. It's such an enormous explosion of graciousness on God's part to heap up over anybody who has suffered anything because of faith in the truth that Jesus brought us, that the suffering is heaped upon, heaped upon, heaped upon until the magnitude of the glory that's given is not even, I mean, it just buries this investment to nothing. It's not even a blip. It's not worthy to be compared. It's kind of like I was thinking of these guys like Hawking and some of these notorious atheists who are so brilliant in their own thinking and in their own minds, and they think they can pronounce about all kinds of stuff. And the real truth of them is this. We live in a universe that is beyond our grasp in terms of magnitude. We can't even build a telescope that can reach to the end of the finitude of the creation. And here we have this humongous trillions of miles of space distance of physical, limited, finite creation. And here you have this little mote floating around in the sun because the breeze has stirred it up. It's a little dust mote. And that's this arrogant mouth speaking about how much it knows about all of this creation and how there's no God and all that kind of stuff. It's just nonsense. Because this little mote of dust mote, is not worthy to be compared to the magnitude of the creation. It's as if there's no comparison at all. And what Paul is trying to say is no exaggeration. He's not exaggerating. He says, I operate on this fundamental conviction. I consider as the most fundamental truth that it doesn't matter how much I have to suffer to be faithful to Christ, because no matter how much I have to suffer, it won't even be a dust mote's worth in comparison to the magnitude of the glory that is to be revealed to us. A God who's infinite can offer that kind of enormous capacity and glory. He can promise you glory beyond your imagination. Things that have not been seen, things that have not been heard, not even have entered into the heart of man, which God has prepared for those who trust Him, walk with Him. And so Paul's whole idea here in verse 18 is the foundation of all of the ministry hassles that he has put up with in his life as a believer in Jesus. Doesn't matter what you're having to suffer. What matters is whether you believe that suffering is going to be met by God's recompense with such a magnitude of overwhelming grace that you won't even hardly remember it, except as the memory may need to be there for the service of whatever. It's just going to be a mind-blowing thing to be ushered into the presence of the glory. Paul says, that's my bottom line. That's why I suffer. That's why I put up with whatever it is I put up with. He's going to develop the thought further into the chapter, but for now, the point of the verse is, I reckon this. I consider this.